This week, we study one of the pivotal events in the history of the scriptures and the world, the long-anticipated exile of the northern kingdom of Israel to Assyria. We find the narrative in 2 Kings 17 and 18, 9 through 12. Therein, we read about how Hoshea, the final king of the northern kingdom, acted as yet another in a lengthy list of all evil kings. Jehovah finally had enough of the nonsense, and so he rid the land of not just the king, but the whole kingdom. They were conquered and were taken away as slaves. This consequence had been forewarned from the earliest times. Moses himself listed it as a consequence for disobedience against Jehovah, and several prophets had warned Israel that this fate was coming. But they would not listen, and so they fell. This, I think, should be a stern warning to us. Sin has consequences, and when a nation sins, those consequences fall on everyone. And of course, in examining this important historical event, we'll have opportunity to consider some important historical questions. Questions like, what happened to the northern tribes after the exile? Or, when did this happen in history? All our effort on the timeline for the last many years will finally bear full fruit. This event will also set up important themes that will resonate throughout the scriptures, for it is here that the Samaritans appear. Your passage for consideration is 2 Kings 17, and if you have not read it yet, I recommend that you pause and do so now. No one should have been surprised when the exile came. Israel had been warned about this from the time of Moses himself. You will recall that the nation of Israel got their start as slaves in the land of Egypt, way back in Exodus. In that book, we read of how Jehovah, the one true God, heard their cries for deliverance and brought them out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Then in the wilderness, he made a covenant with them that if they would obey his laws, then he would be their God and would give them a good land to live in, where he would be their protector and provider. But at that same time, he promised them that there would be curses for disobedience. In Deuteronomy 28, Moses listed off these curses. There at verses 36 and 37, he forewarned, "The Lord will bring you and your king, whom you set over you, to a nation that neither you nor your fathers have known. And there you shall serve other gods of wood and stone. And you shall become a horror, a proverb, and a byword among all the peoples where the Lord will lead you away." The Israelites agreed to this, and then with God's miraculous intervention, they crossed into and conquered the promised land. For centuries, they lived under the rule of their judges, and then under Saul, David, and Solomon, they lived under a unified kingdom. But the unity would be brief. After Solomon's death, the northern tribes of Israel split from the southern tribes, and the northern kingdom of Israel was born, the counterpart to the southern kingdom of Judah. Go back and have a look at 1 Kings 11 and 12 and our message Rehoboam's Folly, published March 17, 2024, for that. And then, as we have studied for week after week, the northern kingdom lost their way. Judah had a mixed record. Some of their kings were good, and some of their kings were bad. Such was never the case for Israel. They had only bad kings, 19 of them in a row, hailing from 9 different dynasties. Half of the time, the new king was just whichever guy killed the old king. The rule of law, and particularly the rule of God's law, was little or nothing for them. And so God sent them prophets to warn them. Obviously, throughout the books of Kings, we've given ample consideration to characters like Elijah and Elisha. They aren't the ones who prophesied the exile, though. To find those prophecies, we have to look elsewhere, to the minor prophetic books of the Bible. So far, we've only considered a couple of these. Jonah was an interesting case. Back in the reign of Jeroboam II, 6 kings and some 50 years prior, God had sent him to the Assyrians at Nineveh to call for their repentance. Jonah didn't want to go, presumably because he was able to see that God was preparing them for the service of destroying the northern kingdom. We haven't looked at the other prophets who foretold that the exile was coming, but we'll get around to some at some point. We find, for example, in Amos 7:17, that Amos said of Israel, "Your wife shall be a prostitute in the city, and your sons and your daughters shall fall by the sword, and your land shall be divided up with a measuring line. You yourself shall die in an unclean land, and Israel shall surely go into exile away from its land." Hosea 9:1-3 is another example. "Rejoice not, O Israel, exult not like the peoples, for you have played the whore, forsaking your God. You have loved a prostitute's wages on all threshing floors. Threshing floor and wine vat shall not feed them, and the new wine shall fail them. They shall not remain in the land of the Lord, but Ephraim shall return to Egypt, and they shall eat unclean food in Assyria." Or Micah 1:15-16. "I will again bring a conqueror to you, inhabitants of Marishah. The glory of Israel shall come to Adullam. Make yourselves bald and cut off your hair, for the children of your delight. Make yourselves as bald as the eagle, for they shall go from you into exile." So let us make no mistake. This is not just some accident of history. It is not just a thing that so happened to happen. From the beginning, Israel had been warned that this would be a consequence for their evil deeds, but they would not listen. As time went on, the warnings became clearer and more frequent and more urgent. The northern kingdom of Israel knew, or should have known, that this was coming. They had generations of opportunity to change their ways, but they would not. And so finally, the exile came. We begin our contemplation of the exile with a look back at some historical context mentioned elsewhere in the scriptures. To take Wikipedia's account of the date, the first captives were taken in 732 BC. They were taken, the scriptures tell us, see 1 Chronicles 5:25 through 26, by Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. You may remember him from last week's message on 2 Chronicles 28 and 2 Kings 16. There we discussed Ahaz, king of Judah, and how he called on Tiglath-Pileser for help in repelling attacks by the northern kingdom. Those attacks came from King Pekah, whom we discussed 2 weeks ago. In that discussion, we found in 2 Kings 15:29 that Tiglath-Pileser captured several of Israel's northern cities, indeed all of Naphtali, the verse tells us, along with Gilead, the East Jordan region. 1 Chronicles 5:25 through 26 bolsters that. It says that Tiglath-Pileser, whom it also references by the alternate name Pul, brought into exile the East Jordan tribes, namely the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. The passage says that he brought them to Halah, Habor, Hara, and the river Gozan. For the Israelites, this would be some 300 miles from home, into the heart of the Assyrian Empire. The river Gozan is a tributary of the Euphrates River in modern-day Syria. The passage also tells us that these captured Israelites remained captive in these places to this day, that being to the time when the passage was written, hundreds of years later, after Judah had already returned from their own exile. With that context, we finally move on to the passage. Hoshea seized the throne of Israel by killing his predecessor Pekah in what 2 Kings 15:30 calls the 20th year of Jotham. This is perhaps a confusing way to put it, since Jotham of Judah did not reign for 20 years and was already dead by this point. That year was, by my count, 217 after the split between the two kingdoms. There was, however, apparently a period of upheaval thereafter, during which time Hoshea's grip on power was in question, because in today's passage 2 Kings 17:1 tells us that Hoshea began his reign in the 12th year of Ahaz. That leaves a chaotic gap of about 7 or 8 years. So Hoshea killed Pekah in 217 post-split, but didn't take the throne until 225 post-split. From there, he would reign for 9 years, with Samaria falling to the Assyrians in 234 post-split. This is an exciting point for people who are interested in the timeline, because the fall of Samaria to the Assyrian Empire is an event we can definitively date to the rest of world history. The year was 722 BC. Keep that in the back of your mind. We'll take a trip through the timeline shortly. At some point after Hoshea killed Pekah, Tiglath-Pileser passed from the scene and Shalmaneser took over as the king of Assyria. Hoshea agreed to become his vassal, but he swore loyalty deceptively. He paid tribute for a few years and then sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, hoping that he would help him rebel against Shalmaneser. But too bad for him, the plan wouldn't play out. Hoshea stopped paying the tribute, and apparently So didn't do much to back him up. Shalmaneser responded by attacking the northern kingdom of Israel and laying siege to their capital city of Samaria. Today's passage tells us at verse 5 that the Assyrians besieged the land for 3 years. That is probably more accurately something like a little longer than 2 years, since according to 2 Kings 18:9, the siege began in Hoshea's 7th year. That, incidentally, is also reckoned as the 4th year of Hezekiah. By our timeline, the siege lasted from 232 to 234 post-split. And then it happened. Samaria fell. According to both 2 Kings 17:6 and 18:9 through 10, the Assyrians rushed in and King Shalmaneser took the people away as captives to Assyria, just like the ones he had taken before. These resettlements, incidentally, were a tool commonly employed by the Assyrians to maintain control of their empire. A people living in their own land were prone to defend that land. If they had a dense social network there, they were more prone to organize rebellion. They would have local identity and resent foreign overlords. But if they were resettled, they were spread out. They would just be surrounded by a bunch of foreigners. They would be struggling to get by in a strange place with strange customs and no one to help them. The Assyrians hoped that after a generation or so, they'd just integrate into the melting pot and become Assyrian in their identity. And while they were shipping the people of Israel off and diluting them around the empire, they were resettling other people into Israel's land. So if the Israelites ever did somehow band together and try to reclaim their territory, there'd be a bunch of other people there ready to stop them. It was an ingenious way to go about controlling people. It ruined their lives, of course, but it strengthened the people at the top. And so a mix of new people captured from elsewhere were exiled out to Israel. The passage gives the names of a smattering of cities from places spread all over the Assyrian Empire at that time, saying that the settlers were brought from those places. So those people were dropped off in and around Samaria. This new mongrel race of people came to be called the Samaritans. They would be much hated by the Jews because they were a people of foreign culture who served foreign gods, had a mixed race, and lived on what had been the Promised Land. Look for the Jewish-Samaritan conflict to pop up several times throughout the New Testament. It comes as little surprise that upon their arrival, the Samaritans did not have an easy time of it. Obviously, they didn't fear Jehovah. They didn't know his laws. The Israelites had not been living as his people, but these Samaritans really weren't doing so. Certainly, Jehovah wouldn't have given these people the coveted promised land for any reason except that he was punishing his own people. So he sent lions to kill them. So many settlers died that news of this reached the king of Assyria. It was explained to him that the people were suffering because they did not know the laws of the God of the land. The common idea in the ancient Near East was that gods were very nationally and geographically focused. Every nation of people had its own place, and every place had its own people, and each place and people had their own god. Most of these people were worshippers of a multitude of gods. They didn't really have the concept of one all-powerful deity. They conceived of their gods as being more local and limited to a certain area. So their concept was that when moving to a new place, one needed to know the requirements of the god of that place. Obviously, this isn't really accurate, but at least they got the general idea that these resettled people needed to know the Torah. And so they took one of the priests whom they had captured and sent him back to Bethel, where he taught them, at least in some measure, how to fear Jehovah. I detect a little tragic irony in sending the man to Bethel. That was the city where Jeroboam had famously set up his golden calf to be worshipped. Apparently, it took all of this to get a priest back in there teaching after so much time. I wonder what he thought when he passed by the place where the calf had stood. Not 250 years ago, Solomon had stood there, reigning over an empire that reached all the way to the Euphrates, and now, after such a short time, so many of his people had been taken away as slaves. Even with some instruction, though, these people still continued the age-old sin, dating back to Solomon, of setting up shrines in the high places. And at those places, they continued worshiping their old gods in the old detestable ways, even burning their children in the fire as sacrifices, much as the Canaanites had done for Molech before Joshua had driven them out so many centuries before. Jehovah, for them, became just another god in the pantheon, some of whose rituals and rules were added to the mix. The passage tells us clearly that this kind of misbehavior went on, passed from parent to child, until, quote, this day, end quote, the day when 2 Kings was written. Chronicles was written later, after the Babylonian captivity, while 2 Kings was written at the time of the Babylonian captivity. So, the Samaritans went on acting that way for at least the next 133 years. Really, though, the pattern would last much longer than that. Samaria was still known for its divergent religious practices in the time of Christ some 700 years thereafter. See the story of the woman at the well in John 4. Today's passage also makes a point of emphasizing why all of this happened, and it does that with frequent references to Israel's history. We looked into some of that history ourselves earlier in giving all of this context, but let's listen to what the passage itself says about that. In 2 Kings 17:35-40, the passage reminds us that Jehovah had made a covenant with the people of Israel. It specifically denoted a few things. First, that Jehovah made this covenant with Israel at the time when he brought them out of Egypt. Verse 7 reiterates that also. Second, that the covenant people of Israel were to revere him alone as God. Third, that the covenant required the people of Israel to obey his rules and laws. And fourth, that the covenant required the people of Israel to make sacrifices to him. Obviously, we see all of that recorded very clearly in the Torah. And yet, tragically, the people of Israel chose to forsake the covenant by living in disobedience to God. Repeatedly, they are described in these chapters as refusing to listen. 2 Kings 18:12 relays as much, saying that they would neither listen to nor obey the commands of Moses, and thus they transgressed the covenant. 2 Kings 17:8 says that in disobeying, the people acted like the Canaanites whom God had driven out before them. They did this by building high places and making offerings there to idols, which the covenant expressly prohibits and which we have studied many times throughout the Book of Kings. When they did those things, did Jehovah immediately and mercilessly destroy them? Or did Jehovah ignore the problem? Did he fail to give any warning until he swept the people away? Not at all. As we've mentioned, 2 Kings 17:13 agrees. Time and again, Jehovah sent prophets who told the people to turn from their wicked ways, but they would not listen. They just kept on ignoring God's laws and making for themselves more idols. God was angry about this. The passage mentions how Israel eventually split from the chosen house of David and set Jeroboam up as king. Then he set up golden calves to worship. And so Israel murdered their sons and daughters and sacrificed them in the fire to their false gods. Obviously, God was angry about this. And so in the end, God removed these people from the land as a punishment for their sins, leaving only Judah behind. Or so to speak. The northern tribes went into exile and they never really came back. They are, for that reason, sometimes known as the 10 lost tribes of Israel. However, that name is not accurate and not really helpful. For one thing, while we usually think of the southern kingdom of Judah as having consisted of only one of the tribes, that being obviously Judah, the fact is that the split between north and south had never been clean cut. Simeon was landlocked inside of Judah. The Simeonites didn't really lose their identity, but they were just sort of wrapped up in Judah and get virtually no attention after Joshua apportioned their land. Likewise, as we have seen in the past, Benjamin was Judah's northern border and really was always part of the southern kingdom. Even at the time of the split, Benjamin sent soldiers to fight for King Rehoboam in 1 Kings 12. And of course, since the Levites were dispersed throughout the land, having no tribal allotment of their own, and since Judah maintained the true faith, the Levites largely migrated there after the split. The Danites had never really taken their allotted land. Most of them had moved north to the city of Dan, but then some, like Samson's family, had lived in the territory of Dan during Philistine occupation. As we've seen many times throughout the wars between the northern and southern kingdoms, the borders were always in flux, and the territory of Dan usually was on Judah's side of the line. In fact, significant portions of the tribal allotment to Ephraim also was under Judah's control at various times. So with considerations like that alone, at least some portion of six different tribes were under Judah's control at the time of the Assyrian exile. Those tribes weren't lost, they just integrated with Judah. They lost the Israelite moniker and merged to become the Jews. And there is good reason to believe that there was at least some representation of every tribe present in this new Jewish cohort, because the New Testament talks about them. Luke chapter 1 mentions that Zechariah and his wife were descendants of Aaron. Luke 2:36 says that Anna the prophetess was of the tribe of Asher. Paul wrote in Romans 11:1 that he was a Benjaminite. In Acts 26:7, Paul said that he was on trial for the hope which the 12 tribes sought to obtain. Apparently, he believed that there were still 12 tribes at the time. James agreed. He addressed his book to the 12 tribes in dispersion, that is, scattered among the Roman Empire. And of course, whether or not these 12 tribes continue to attain much distinction to this day, God Almighty knows where to find their members. If Revelation is to be taken literally on the point, the tribes will last until the end of the world. We read at Revelation 7:4-8 of the sealing of the 12 tribes, notably with Dan missing from the list. The point, though, is this. The northern kingdom was gone, but that doesn't mean that all the tribes were gone. A remnant from the tribes lived on in Judah and remained distinctive among the Jews even in the New Testament era. And wherever it is that any of them may have gone to in their dispersion, even if they don't know it themselves, God knows who they are, and so they aren't really lost. The days of the northern kingdom of Israel, though, end here. These people who were taken captive did not come back, and nor did their descendants, to reform a kingdom in this territory. And from this point onward, we will pay very little attention to the tribes anymore. For the most part, we've got two distinct groups now, the Jews in Judah and the Samaritans in Samaria. And now, after many years of hard work, I'm proud to finally put some finishing polish onto our timeline. The Bible records the number of years that various events took from all the way back in Genesis. There in chapter 5, we start getting, "This one was so many years old when he fathered that one." We followed these closely to determine that Noah's flood occurred in 1656 after the creation. See our very old message, Genealogy, Omphalism, published April 24, 2016, for that. From the flood to Jacob's arrival in Egypt, we determined that another 582 years passed, such that Jacob met Pharaoh in 2238 AC, after creation. We determine that in a message titled Descendants of Jacob, Timeline, Contradictions in the Bible. And note, as always, that the word contradictions there was in quotes. There are no contradictions in the Bible. From there, it was 430 years till the Exodus, that from Exodus 12, meaning that Israel walked out of Egypt in 2668 AC. Construction on Solomon's Temple began 480 years after the Exodus, in what would have been about 3148 AC. See our message, Solomon's Temple, published February 5th, 2023. Then, according to our message, Rehoboam's Folly, published March 17th, 2024, Solomon reigned for 40 years, 36 years after he had laid the temple foundation, which means that the northern and southern kingdoms split in 3184 AC. The northern kingdom fell approximately 234 years later, in 3418 AC. If that was 722 BC, before Christ, and today is 2025 AD, then the world today would be 6,165 years old. So if you're accustomed to working in years BC, before Christ, rather than AC, after creation, let's work that backward. Israel fell in 722 BC. The split was in 956 BC. Solomon laid the temple foundations in 992 BC. The Exodus occurred in 1472 BC. Jacob met Pharaoh in 1902 BC. The flood was in 2484 BC. And the world was created in 4140 BC. That is what the Bible teaches. But of course, that comes with all of the standard caveats. Caveats like assuming that 722 BC is actually correct as the date when Israel fell, or the dates are imprecise, so we could get off by a year with every generation, or these are my own calculations and I could have made an error somewhere, or scholarly opinion can differ on how exactly some of this fit together. But now, after 9 years of paying very close attention to this as we've worked through the Bible, I think that the best number, or at least the best number that you're ever going to get out of me, is that today, in 2025 AD, the world is 6,165 years old. I've been waiting patiently to get to this point in the Bible so that I can put a period on that sentence for a long time. In application, we note briefly, as we have many times before, that sin has consequences. God is all-knowing and all-loving. He knows what is best for us, and He has graciously given us good laws which, if we obey them, will give us our best lives. If you want to have a society that stays healthy and grows wealthy, then you're going to want to have people whose rights are respected and who do things efficiently and effectively. God's laws help people do that. Ignoring God's laws does the opposite. Sin tears down rather than building up. Israel ignored God's laws. Rather than reproducing, they were whoring. Rather than raising up the next generation of innovators and workers and soldiers, they were selfishly burning their children in the fire as a sacrifice to Molech. Rather than working, they were stealing. They were following the ways of the nations, which Jehovah had driven out before them. They were sinning, and they were hurting each other. They were a stench in God's nostrils. And so not only were the natural consequences of sin weakening them and making them ripe for collapse, but God was ready to unleash the supernatural consequences on them. Your sins are no different. If you live in sin, there will be consequences. Your sin will weaken you, and it will make you a stench to God. But we must be keenly aware, the consequences of sin don't fall only on the sinner. It is obvious that the sin harms not just the sinner, but everyone around him. The thief steals. Well, in doing so, he at least gains a few dollars, but his victim suffers. And as we've discussed, a culture of theft has broader harms. People who are continually robbed lose the desire to work. No point in working just to pay the thieves. Next thing you know, no one is working, and there aren't enough goods in the market, and the prices go up. The whole society gets weaker. The rewards of righteousness and the consequences of sin fall on everyone. And so we must also remember that we are our brother's keepers. We live in a society today that wants to say, "Don't judge me and mind your own business," or "What I'm doing is none of your concern." Well, that's not the biblical view on it. The reality is that everyone's doing is everyone else's concern. When our brothers are sinning, we should stop them, because if we don't, that sin is going to come around and hurt us as well. When someone strays from the path, we have a duty to speak reasonably and frankly with that person to get them back on the way. And when we are off the way, we have a duty to listen with humility so that we can get back on. When a brother won't come along, we have a duty to perform church discipline. We have a duty throughout society to enforce moral laws, God's laws, not man's laws. If we do that, then we can expect our society to do well. If we won't do that, then we can expect our society to falter. To conclude then, since 1 Kings 11, which we studied back in March of 2024, we've spent about 40 messages contemplating the northern kingdom of Israel. The rift between Ephraim and Judah had been a long one, dating all the way back to Jacob's favoritism toward Joseph in the book of Genesis. The tribes were united as one kingdom for a time, but after Solomon, the good feelings broke down. Taxes were high, and the northern kingdom refused to make Solomon's son Rehoboam king. Instead, they went for Jeroboam, son of Nebat, but Jeroboam was a bad king who led the northern kingdom into idolatry. The northern kingdom had a chaotic 234-year run before their sins finally did them in. The northern kingdom of Israel often warred with the southern kingdom of Judah. Eventually, in the reign of Pekah, this led to the king of Judah calling on the Assyrians to fight the northern kingdom. One generation later, Hoshea was no match for the Assyrian Empire. The scriptures are very clear that this was no accident of history. The northern kingdom had been steeped in sin, and as a result, God was against them. He gave them generations of warnings, and when they would not listen, he finally sent them away into exile. From here on in the narrative, for all practical purposes, Israel is no more. We will consider instead the Jews of Judah and the Samaritans of Samaria. We are reminded herein that sin has consequences, and not only that, but sin has general consequences. It is not only the individual sinner who is punished for his sin, but the society generally which is punished. It falls on all of us then to be our brother's keepers, that we may ensure a strong society. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.